You're listening to Pod for Ham, a podcast from The Incomparable that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time through the original Broadway cast recording. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track. Visit us on the web at pod4ham.com or follow us on Twitter at pod4ham.
Ah, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Burr.
Sir. And did you hear the news about good old General Mercer?
No.
You know Claremont Street?
Yeah.
They renamed it after him. The Mercer legacy is secure.
Sure.
And all he had to do was die.
Yeah, that's a lot less work.
We ought to give it a try.
Hi, this is Michael B. Johnson.
This is Camille Washington.
And this is Allison Barry.
And this is Serenity Caldwell. And we are talking Pod for Ham, the room where it happens.
We're all in the big old room.
We are. The big old virtual room. I'm sure you could make a whole host full of metaphors. So this is one of my favorite songs in the show. I feel like if you took a poll of Hamilton fans, it would also be pretty high up there for them as well. I think Nonstop slightly edges it out, but there's a lot happening in this room. there's a lot to unpack. So we're just going to kind of go from the top and see what we can find. See what arts of the compromise we can make. Michael, I'm going to start with you. What do you feel about this song?
This is an interesting song for me because it's it probably was my favorite when I listened to it and I had no idea why. And then because it just seemed really it just was a great song. And it was also kind of it harked back to the line that I really the sort of the one line that was my favorite line when I first listened to it about the, you know, talk less, smile more. And then the more I listened to it and then when I saw the show, then I was almost a little more confused about it because I'm like, I don't actually know what the hell's going on here. And then finally I came all the way around to basically deciding that it was the most, well, I don't want to say most, but it's an extraordinarily intelligent song because half of it is, it's just playing with all of the parts of the show. There's something that actually happened. There's sort of a head game going on, Burr talking to himself, talking to a Hamilton that sort of only exists in his head. And then enough of the facts are correct that make it really, really interesting. And it spoke to me because in what I do for a living, when you work on films, you always kind of want to be in the room where it happens. You want to be where creatively some part of the movie, you saw it go from not there to there. And so it really speaks to me as something that, you know, it's something that I want, but it's also something, this is sort of where Burr loses his soul. And so, anyway, I find it a really powerful song, and it's one of the few songs in this, more than almost anything else, that actually kind of keeps reopening itself up to me as something that's really interesting.
Layers upon layers upon layers.
Yeah, yeah.
Camille, what about you? What is this? What does the room where it happens mean to you?
I mean, Michael stole many words out of my mouth. But I would just add that I was thinking about other musicals that I love, and I think it functionally reminds me a lot of And I'm Telling You from Dreamgirls.
Mm.
In the way that, in a lot of ways, I mean, one, the song is obviously like a star-making vehicle for Leslie Odom Jr., but also for the character, right? Like, this is where we see Aaron Burr sort of coming into his own and understanding his own motivations, and it's huge. I mean, obviously he's been a big part of the show up to this point, but this is a really deep, intense moment with him, and we get taken through so many emotional facets, but also just like musically we learn so much about the Aaron Burr character just from the style of the song. And as we were saying, it's the layers upon layers upon layers. So much here.
The banjo. The wonderful banjo.
That twangy, like, vaudeville-y piano. It's like a little sleazy, a little foreboding, a little like jazzy, bluesy. So good.
So great. Allison.
Well, I'm going to try to not retread ground. So I'll come at it from a political perspective. I live and work in D.C., and I am, in fact, a Virginian. So generally, anytime Madison and Jefferson are hyped up in a song, I'm super pumped. And Aaron Burr is my favorite character. And what I love about this is that it's not only narratively propelling, you know, the action of the story, you know, filling out character moments for Jefferson, for Madison, and then ultimately revealing, you know, Burr's. And I think, Michael, maybe you were a little bit too harsh in terms of villainy. I mean, just wanting to be in the room is in itself bad. I mean, just only in my view, it's only bad, like, in opposition to Hamilton's worldview, where it's like principles or GTFO. but the political undertones of the song are so relevant and so fantastic, just talking about the way compromise works. And maybe the analogy isn't as appropriate to the way, like, Congress particularly operates now, because kind of those backroom deals are no longer a thing. Things have just become so polarized, they don't even talk to each other in the halls. But, you know, even 10 years ago, you know, the art of the compromise, hold your nose and close your eyes, there was a lot of, like, there's horse trading. And as the populace, what do we want people to do? Like, why do we send them to these rooms? Like, we want them to get things done. You know, it's not always going to be pretty. So it's just to have such a relevant message. And then kind of like, as you were saying, Serenity, that twangy, bluesy kind of Chicago meets Oh Brother Where Art Thou, like old timey kind of beat. It's also like, it's the most kind of Broadway song, because like you can hear, you know, the chorus line in it, basically. Like, I haven't even seen the show yet, and I'm like, no, there's high kicks happening here. Like, high kicks in politics. I don't know, man. It's just...
one thing I just wanted to sort of go back on, though, was that the notion that... Because I went and reread the part in Chernow's book about the dinner, and Jefferson literally traces the two-party system to that dinner. Because remember back then, having multiple parties was not considered a feature. It was a bug, right? That, you know, cause it was supposed to be individuals talking to each other about stuff as opposed to, you know, partisan lines that, oh, I'm on this side and you're on that side. And Jefferson very specifically considered it to be sort of people who had the Confederation of the States at heart versus, you know, closet royalists or something. And then the other part, I'm going to stand by my villainy bit, because as far as I'm concerned, this is what I mean by I think this song is really interesting, because I didn't think this, say, 3 or 6 months ago. But if I was rereading the lyrics again today, and it's basically Burr, the only reason he wants to be there is because something's happening. He doesn't have a particular point he's trying to make in the room. It's just totally frosting his ass that he's not in that room where this stuff is going on. And Hamilton, like, is willing to kind of hold his nose and be like Burr and go and compromise, which he never does, because he has this very specific thing that he thinks that this is the only way that he can actually get the thing done. While
that ties into, like, the best annotation in the Hamilton and a Revolution book, which is Lin-Manuel makes that annotation of Hamilton saying, if I act like you, I can get this deal done, which leaves Burr asking the question, why am I, who act like me all the time, not invited? Why am... like, that is so sad to me. Like, I'm just like, oh, Burr, you putz. Like,
you don't get the point. You're missing the forest for the trees here.
but that's why the song's so great, because it's fundamentally a shallow activity that he wants to engage in. It's not that I want to save the country. I want to build something that's going to outlast me. That's what Hamilton's saying. Burr's just going, God damn it, there's a party and I'm missing out.
I think it's really interesting that this song comes right after Say No to This, where we see that sort of, not sort of, we see that moral failing in Hamilton, right?
And the folly of ambition, right?
Like, yeah. And seeing it from each side, from the Hamilton side and from the Burr side, I think that complicates, you know, what we would consider as heroism on Hamilton's part or villainy on Burr's part, right?
Well, it's banality. It's not villainy. It's just the fact that, you know,
they're both people.
Well, yeah. And I'm not I'm not necessarily saying Hamilton is Lily White or anything, but just in this particular song, he's doing what he considers a bad thing for a good reason. While Burr, it's just he's kind of like, hey, where are you guys going? What are you doing? You know.
It is kind of nice that when he makes his reveal, like, it's whispered. It's like, I want to be in the... Like, he realizes, like, this is a thing I should be ashamed of.
This is guilty. Well, yeah, he starts so softly in that, right? Where you have the first... If we go back to, you know, the sort of the structure of the song, we've got this little patter song between Burr and Hamilton, where Hamilton is basically saying nothing. He is talking less and smiling more. And Burr's like, talk to me. What's going on? Talk to me. And then you've got sort of the interjection from Madison and Jefferson as like, this is how it all went. So rumors say. And finally you have Burr start really quiet and be like, I want to be in the room where it happens. Yeah. And then by the end of the number, he is screaming it. He is screaming it to the heavens, being like, I have the biggest case of, you know, 18th century FOMO that ever existed. Please let me in.
Well, and that's the thing is it drives directly to the end there because it's because the Burr in the earlier part of this show, he would have totally let all the comments that Hamilton made at that dinner that he got so offended by. He would have just been like, yeah, whatever. I'm playing the long game here, pal. I can just let that go. But he can't because at this point he's like, God damn it. Stuff's going on.
We're pretty far into the long game, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, I think that's
I can't play the long game unless I'm in the room where it happens.
Well, that's the change there, right? That's when he suddenly goes, my strategy isn't working.
And then he flips parties. Yeah, parties that aren't supposed to exist.
Yes, exactly. The parties that Washington never wanted in the first place. Oh, well.
One of the interesting things about going back to the Chesbro book and reading about sort of what was going on at the time was the fact that it seemed like the deal was going to happen anyway, and that Hamilton didn't necessarily need to give up New York. And it was also interesting because Madison actually still voted against Hamilton, the whole assumption thing, but he supposedly convinced four other senators to vote for it, and that actually is what made it pass.
Yeah, in all the state Virginia history that we get crammed down our throats, I grew up in Virginia. I went to public school in the state and went to college here. So, whoop-de-doo. But they do sort of start talking about how, like, it was sort of an inevitability that they were going to geographically move the capital because it was just going to be a more central location. Like, if you think about the geography of the 13 colonies, like, top of Virginia, bottom of Maryland just makes sense. And the Potomac was, like, a good entry point. And straight up, they were having to do a lot of rebuilding in New York all the time. So it made for, like, a lot of chaos. Whereas designing a whole new capital city was very in vogue. Like, a lot of European countries had done that. So, like, you know, they built a new city and designed it to be very easy to defend. And it's got the worst stupid traffic circles in the world, but those originally served a purpose. And, like, so it was something that I think was going to happen. And I get why narratively, like, for this story, like, it's important for, you know, there to be some more drama around it. The thing I've always wondered about, though, is, like, was there ever a conversation about the banks leaving New York and moving to Philadelphia? Because that could have been, like, an actual historical source of drama.
Well, in the Chesbro book, it actually, yeah, there was no notion, like, New York was just straight up pissed. And in there, it didn't seem to think that it was... was inevitable that they were going to move it to, you know, the side of the Potomac there. But then again, there's a reason I live on the West Coast and I just came from crazy, super hot East Coast. So I'm going to not defend any of those places for a place that you'd want to be in the summer. But anyway.
They definitely built the Capitol in a swamp.
Yeah.
No one knows why.
Right. That was my memory that, like, you know, government was in trouble till they invented air conditioning, and then they could actually like stay there for 3 or 4 months that they would have had to leave.
They got the land so cheap because neither Virginia nor Maryland wanted it.
Like, yes, you want to be on the Potomac? Okay, have all of the mosquitoes and all of the heat.
Well, but yeah, there's a river, sure. Like, yeah. Breezes? Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I also would think that historically, if you grow up in a place, they're totally going to tell you the good reasons why they, of course, they were going to put the capital here.
Well, see, it's interesting. I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia, which was the colonial capital. And there is like historians there that still have salt about the capital leaving Williamsburg and moving up because Southern Virginia does not consider Northern Virginia part of Virginia. It's a whole thing.
And then there's West Virginia, which is a whole separate issue.
A whole separate Virginia.
Yeah, I'm very confused.
You guys have some feelings about borders and
Virginians.
Capitals.
Virginians have feelings about literally everything involving the founding. Like Alexander Hamilton was one of the great villains of history in my history books, which is hilarious that now like I've grown up and I've fallen in love with this fictional version of him from this musical.
So I really actually want to know what is villain Alexander Hamilton look like in the Virginia history books? I feel like that's a good aside for this semi-villain introduction song.
They leave out all of like the super hot pictures that are in the Chernow book. Like, oh my gosh. Like, never had any idea he was a total babe. Like
it's like only have drawings of him like hunched over writing desk being like, I'm going to do the downfall of the colonies.
Well, I mean, it's pretty standard practice that at some point in middle or high school, you do a field trip to Monticello in Charlottesville. And you tour it. It's all set up. You can see Jefferson's study and his bedroom, which is actually a bed wedged in a little hallway. And if you roll out the left side of the bed, you're in the office. If you roll out the right side of the bed, you're in, like, the dressing room.
Nice.
Dude was serious about his work. But he, there's, like, a wall with, like, hunting trophies on it. And they have this, like, empty plaque up there. And they're like, oh, yeah, he used to keep a bust of Alexander Hamilton on the wall.
What?
And he used to, like, throw stuff at it. Like,
oh, my God, Thomas, be regular for, like, 2 seconds.
Wow.
Thomas Jefferson did not know normal.
No, he was he was
the most extra founding father in my personal opinion.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Chernow book on here, and it's the quote from Jefferson is, I was duped into it by the Secretary of the Treasury and made a tool for forwarding his schemes, not then sufficiently understood by me, and of all the errors of my political life, this has occasioned me the deepest regret. So he was a little bitter.
Just a little. But Jefferson did everything. Jefferson arranged the room, the meeting, the venue, the seating.
There were three chairs.
I know. It's not like he was throwing a banquet for like the heads of state. It's three people in a room in New York.
In swivel chairs.
Well, but that's like typical Jefferson, though, of where he's sort of like, well, I didn't know. You know, and he totally freaking knew. He just, you know, cause the whole, this was a thing that, and you guys may all know all this, but just in the context of a podcast, I'll just explain the assumption, you know, sort of what was going on here was the fact that the federal government was going to assume all the state debt, and the Virginians, you know, they were like, we have a lot of that. And or like, we're fine. We don't want somebody else's debt. You know, we don't, you know, this is sort of not a good thing. And they finally got convinced to allow the federal government to do that. But what that meant was the federal government then had – you sort of were tied to the federal government. You couldn't, you weren't going to go leave then. And I just did a really bad job of explaining that. But it was, I thought this was really interesting because that was what Jefferson was so pissed off about, was the fact that he missed that. He missed the fact that the line from Hamilton was, whoever considers the nature of our government with discernment will see that though obstacles and delays will frequently stand in the way of the adoption of good measures, yet once adopted, they are likely to be stable and permanent. It will be far more difficult to undo than to do. And that was sort of the line that drove Jefferson nuts, because basically he missed it.
That sounds very prescient to things that are happening in modern society, actually.
Yeah.
It's, yes, very, very interesting. The thing about Jefferson, that whole midsection of the song, where essentially Jefferson and Madison are doing the same kind of patter that that Burr and Hamilton do in the beginning of the song, where they're just like, maybe we can make this work for Virginians, and not actually considering the, you know, a victory for the Southerners. It's maybe a moral victory, but it's ultimately a hollow victory because the Southerners are going to be basically loaded with taxes and forced, you know, this is the point at which the colonies are still kind of, you know, they've declared independence. They're haphazardly strung together. But there was a real chance that the colonies could have all kind of broken apart and decided to be their own sovereign nations at one point, especially when you have somebody like Virginia, where because they had such a giant slave population, they were able to more or less be self-sufficient. This is the point where the Virginians are now shackled to the United States. And it's as you said, Michael, it's like it's not a place where you can easily leave or take a back door and be like, yeah, I don't like what you're saying. Sorry, I got to go. Now it's like, oh, my financial success is kind of tied to the rest of these colonies. Oops. Oh, well.
Yeah, this is the united part.
Yeah. Sort of face saving in the short term. But whoops. Altered the course of at least the plans of many of the people in charge of the Commonwealth in the long term.
Yep. So can I say my favorite almost unspoken pun in this show is
there are unspoken puns? Come on.
There are unspoken puns on top of, I mean, there's such good wordplay in this song, and it's one of the reasons why I love it so much. But something that I didn't even realize until about 4 months after I listened to it, and I think it's in the Genius annotations too, where they're talking about the U.S. capital, capital C, and they're also talking about monetary capital, lowercase
yes.
C.
That's pretty good.
It's like, he doesn't actually rhyme U.S. capital with monetary capital. He just says, we'll have the banks. Like, do the math yourself. But it makes my heart happy. I'm like, you're getting puns in there under the surface without even having to rhyme them. Like, hate you a little bit as a writer.
It's so that's kind of emblematic, I think, of the greatest strength of this musical, is that a lot of the because it's such a big topic, like, it's not just about Alexander Hamilton, it's about all of these people, it's about the entire act of the founding. So it's so tightly written, like, it's so tightly written, and there's so much information in like 4 words or 2 words or one, like, every word is precisely chosen for a reason.
Yeah, and at every level too, because we have heard throughout the show this harping on legacy, and we know what Alexander Hamilton's legacy is going to be. What's Aaron Burr's? And it's sort of sad that he gets to be like the bitter Betty of the founding fathers. And that ends up being his legacy.
At least he leans into it, like,
yeah, own it.
He was like, he was a bitter bitch about it, like, for a long time. Though apparently, I didn't know this until like very recently. It was like a Jeopardy question. Aaron Burr was the lawyer that handled Mariah Reynolds' eventual divorce.
Yeah,
when she finally left him, when she finally left James Reynolds, Aaron Burr was her attorney.
It's layers upon layers. Yep.
He had to be in all of the rooms where all of the things happened.
Mm-hmm. I said massive FOMO.
Yeah, the one thing I remember from the side notes in the Hamilton tome was the there's the line of Burr, Congress is fighting over where to put the Capitol, and I never understood what people say in there, and it's supposed to be Miranda told the company to like shout the name of any city that would have existed back then, and
any of the 13 colonies,
right? But
definitely shouts Toronto.
Oh, yeah, really? Toronto.
But
yeah.
He's like, but they kind of shout whatever they want, and it's, yeah, it's funny because now I'm always listening. I'm trying to hear the cities. Now I have to listen for Toronto. Okay, that's good.
Toronto and Orlando are both in there.
Mm-hmm. The funny thing about Toronto to me is that they actually pronounce it the way that the Canadians pronounce it, which is Toronto instead of Toronto. So it's the only thing I hear when they're like, friend, where did they put the nation's capital? Toronto! It isn't pretty. Makes me happy. But yeah, the going to the sort of the climax of the song where Burr really kind of breaks it out. And I don't know, Michael, you've seen the show.
Yeah.
Camille, Allison, have you guys seen the show yet?
I'm going on October 27th.
Oh my gosh! Exciting!
I have not been so blessed as to have seen the show, and it feels like I'm never going to see it. It hurts me to say that out loud. Like, is it going to happen for me? I don't know, you guys.
It will happen because it will run for decades. But
yeah, that's real.
They're not going to take it off Broadway or out of touring companies anytime soon. But the thing about, without spoiling too much of the show, this is basically Aaron Burr's centerpiece song, both with, again, we talk about choreography, we talk about, you know, him really coming into his own. There are certain lighting cues that happen. It is really a spectacular. It reminds me a lot, actually. The song that I always compare this to is Scar's song from The Lion King.
Be Prepared?
Like, yeah!
Oh my god!
It's like, I'm sure someone has already done it on YouTube, but I would love a mashup of these two songs because I feel like they actually blend so well. They have like comparant harmonies. But this is what that last minute and a half, because we've basically, you know, it's a 5.5 minute song and we spend 3.5 minutes just kind of setting the stage for Burr to answer the question, like, what do you want? You see all of this stuff happening. What do you want, Burr? What do you want, Burr? What do you want, Burr? And his response is like, all I want to do is be in the room, but here I'm going to make a big show of it so you understand how important it is to me. I don't care if I don't necessarily have, you know, ideals or morals or places that I want to go, but
I'll figure it out once I get there.
Exactly. Exactly. It's interesting to me because I honestly think he, at least the Burr in the musical, can't really speak to the historical guy, but the Burr in the musical feels like I can't make decisions until I'm in the room. You know, I can't have dreams until I'm in the place where it happens, because otherwise, like, I don't even know what I'm supposed to be dreaming for. I don't know what I'm supposed to be accomplishing. I need the power to tell me which way to go.
Well, it's all I. He's not trying to accomplish anything. It's just I. And even just the way they sing it, of just sort of tweaking the I part of it there, it just feels extraordinarily self-indulgent in a good way that was very entertaining. But it's, again, this is, to me, this is where Burr just loses his soul. And at the end of this song, you're just like, oh, you are in a dark place. You know,
dark is a tomb where it happens.
Yeah, really.
Well, it's kind of an interesting, if you compare, like I think Burr wants a legacy the same as Hamilton does, but like their whole approach to legacy is so different. Like, even at the beginning of the song, Burr's starting a conversation about legacy with Hamilton over something as petty as some dude getting a street named after him. Mm-hmm. We don't know who that guy is. So like, really? Like, there was a Mercer Hall at my college. I don't know who it was for. But like, Alexander Hamilton's conception of legacy isn't even connected to his name so much as it is like a thing, like the entire treasury system of the United States. That's a pretty big thing. Whereas you get the sense that Burr's sense of legacy is entirely tied to his name. And maybe that comes from his family. Like, his grandfather was a very significant historical figure. Like, you get the sense that he wants something with Aaron Burr chiseled on the side of it.
Definitely.
Like, mm-hmm. more Definitely. Than anything else. Whereas Hamilton's legacy is, I think, a bit more what we would think of as like a nobler, you know, pursuit, you know, of higher ideals.
Well, and again, I think that's what this whole thing kind of reveals, right? Is that, and like somebody said before, you know, the song before this, you sort of see the humanity, not in the best use of that term, of Hamilton when he's, you know, embroiled in this affair. But in this one, it's sort of like he's doing stuff that he doesn't really want to accomplish some higher goal that is extraordinarily defensible, at least from his perspective. And it's defensible enough that his two greatest political rivals are willing to compromise with him on it. I mean, that tells you right there that this is something that, you know, it's a thing that people of principles were willing to compromise to make happen, while Burr is just pissed he wasn't invited, and this is going to sort of set him on his course for the rest of the show.
I mean, I think while Burr definitely is primarily the bitter bitch of this moment, as we have all agreed, there is a pretty legit critique of like political pragmatism and the system like embedded in this song, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. song is both a love letter and a trenchant critique, and that's brilliant and is just like, that's politics, kids. Like, that's the business. But towards the end, when Burr starts saying, you know, we don't get a say in what they trade away, we dream in the dark for the most part, that's really real, you know? I mean, apart from his not, you know, his wanting to be in the room without actually having anything to say when he gets here. I mean, there's a point there, right?
Right. But I mean, but again, Burr is playing multiple roles here, right? There's
right.
Burr, the character, the historical figure, and then there's Burr, the commentator, the person
the Greek
who's
chorus.
Mm-hmm. The person who's the narrator of this story, and it feels like the part that is the, you know, the banal part of where they're like, I just want to be in there because that's where the cool kids are, is the character. And then the other parts where he's actually sort of explaining things, I think that's the narrator. And I don't want to credit the character for the narrator's words.
But, well, I mean, it's just part of the brilliance of the song.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just all of those layers in there.
Can someone who knows more about...
How different is this from Wait For It?
Right.
Oh my God, it's a complete 180.
Yeah.
You know, it's the, I'm willing to wait for it. I've become impatient. Yeah. I've become impatient. I want it now.
Yeah. Wait For It is the defensible articulation of his perspective, right? This is like, look, all these horrible things have happened. I have these reasons why I want to do this stuff. I'm going to do great things, but I have to wait. And that's defensible. That's, you're like, okay, I have sympathy for this character. And I personally, over time, have lost my sympathy in listening to this song more and more, being like, oh man, he's just done. And so can somebody who understands more about contemporary music than me explain the reference of Click Boom? Because I feel like it's a reference to a song that I just don't know.
I mean, thought it was just like the running motif of shots, booms, things like that, that tend to, well, they're littered throughout the musical, but they're particularly hewn closely to Burr and to Hamilton, probably for obvious reasons. But I didn't think that it was a call out to a specific song.
Okay. I remember on one of those, the kaplow sound on one of them early on, that was some, everybody on the other podcast was like, oh, of course, that's this, you know, Kanye lyric or whatever. And I was like, okay, old white guy over here.
I mean,
sorry, I got no
clue. It's also just like a sound effect that occurs in hip hop music often. And it's just like another one of those kinds of reference points.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a specific song, but a song.
Yeah.
Okay.
A genre.
An affectation.
Yep. On the musical side, just sort of to close out, I really love the way that music is played with here, where the tete-a-tetes, the back and forth, are very simple. It's just a drum machine and you've got a little bit of piano, a little bit of strings. Just like, you know, this is, let's tell this really, really close, really personal, intimate thing. And then when Burr gets into it, it's like, anytime Burr is speaking, let's break out the banjo, everybody. let's make sure it gets, the banjo is such an interesting instrument. As you know, I do not play the banjo, but I find it, as somebody who grew up in a musical history, like family, I find it very interesting that the banjo is the instrument that went to, not only is it an instrument, you know, which you traditionally think of as like the South, or the Midwest, but it's also it is an instrument that demands to be heard. It's like, I've got a bunch of strings and a really wacky sound, and by gosh, you have to listen to me.
I got
nothing.
I've
never heard of banjos described as wacky.
It's wackadoo insistent.
That twang to it, like.
I just like how it's layered in with like the jazzy sounds. Like one of my girlfriends who saw the show talked about how like she was like, the this is the song where the choreography goes like nuts.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're spinning around and jumping on tables and all kinds of stuff. It's great.
There's moments of Fosse, and I'm like, wait, how are you going to put Fosse in a Hamilton show? Damn.
Everything is Fosse.
It's like, you just have to trust it. Yeah. There's so much hidden Fosse.
I also think it's cool with the musical styles how every character is still doing their thing. They're still doing their shtick within Aaron Burr's vaudeville, you know, fantasy land. Like, Hamilton is still, like, primarily rapping, right?
Yep.
Jefferson is still doing his, like, swaggy, mostly rapping, like, braggadocious thing. That's mm-hmm. cool, too.
Yep, they all have their own distinctual voices. And you even get a little bit of the Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, I love every time they, like, layer that riff into another song.
Yeah, the build of the way that the musical builds its songs upon itself, it's probably one of the best musicals to do that. Like, there are some, but I, you know, putting them on a pedestal, I'm like, this just, it layers everything throughout, and all of the first act tunes get reworked and kind of bastardized into act two, and it's really exciting to listen to. And it offers, especially as you know, if you listen to the soundtrack and you're not, or the cast recording, and you're not necessarily a huge musical theater buff, or it's more just like, yeah, I like this. Having those kind of layered musical tones allows you to find things even 9 months after, where you're like, wait a second, that riff is from, oh, you know, like light bulb moments right there.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So to close, why don't we go around and our favorite moment from this song?
I guess I like the when they Hamilton, I think it's Hamilton and everybody else says, wait for it, wait for it. And Hamilton basically says, you know, I want to build something that's going to outlive me. And you kind of remember why Hamilton's doing this, that he's doing it for his principles. He's actually not, as opposed to the last song, he's not sort of throwing away what he's been doing. And then that leads so well because that's Burr's line. Wait for it. Right. And so Hamilton took it and did something a little better with it than Burr was going to do. So I like that. The wait for it, wait for it.
I think I got to go with that Burr breakdown at the very end. And then we get that huge note. And it's just, I mean, not to belabor the point, but just like Leslie Odom Jr., like, why are you so talented? Like, how are you doing that with your voice? Like, it's just crazy to me. And we just feel so much passion in that moment. And just all of it, the styling, how the company is coming in. Got to go Burr breakdown all the way for my favorite moment.
It's actually, I'm also on board with the Burr breakdown, but my second favorite moment is probably Jefferson's relating of how the dinner went. You know, I know you hate him, but let's hear what he has to say, just because it's, I love all opportunities for David Diggs to ham it up as TJ. It is a very different TJ from the one I was, you know, grew up learning about, and it's my favorite TJ. So he's just so much better than the original.
Yeah, he's kind of the best. I'm very sad that he has left the cast, but really excited to see what he's going to do next.
He's going to be on Black-ish.
Yeah. And he's working on some stuff for, I forget which New York theater, but he's doing some playwriting stuff, which is really exciting.
So what's your favorite part, Serenity?
My favorite, I think I love the, like, as I said before, I like the U.S. Capitol, hidden capital metaphors. But I think my favorite is the really, really quick patter where they're going back and forth at the beginning and Toronto. It just makes me happy to hear that line. Yes, let's shout Canada. Let's have Canada be part of the States. All right. Well, thank you very much for participating in The Room Where It Happens. And thank you, listeners. And Pod for Ham will be back very soon.
See everybody.